As most of you know, the core of the primary meditation that we practice here is mindfulness. Mindfulness is that ability that we all have to experience a moment of life just as it is, without adding concepts, judgments, or reactions. It's that ability to be awake and open to whatever life is offering. As we become mindful of more and more moments of our life, we begin to see ourselves and life more clearly. Through this clear seeing, we develop understanding or wisdom and compassion. Wisdom and compassion are the primary qualities that free us from the distress, confusion, or dissatisfaction that we all experience to some degree or another. Wisdom and compassion are the primary qualities that can bring about the deepest possible happiness and peace. Can everybody hear me in the back? Raise your hand if not. Great. So, all of this wisdom and compassion and all of these benefits come simply from mindfulness itself. If mindfulness is so freeing and wonderful, the question can arise, well, what should I be mindful of? What should I pay attention to? The stock market? Television? The weather? It's really a good question. And never fear, because the Buddha answered that question very elaborately and very specifically. His most famous body of instructions on mindfulness is called the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, or in English, the Great Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's a long and meaty discourse, even longer and meatier than its title. So I'm not going to attempt to go through the whole thing tonight. What I'd like to do is to focus just on the first foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the body. Even that section is really long. So rather than go through it point by point, what makes sense to me is to pick and choose some facets of it, and also to contextualize it and interpret it so that it could be relevant to our modern lives. I'll start by talking about a part of the sutta that is one of my perennial favorites. It's mindfulness of posture. I love this because it is so simple. When sitting, know that you're sitting. When standing, know that you're standing. When walking, know that you're walking. When lying down, know that you're lying down. It's pretty straightforward. The Buddha elaborated that you can be mindful on all of the variations of these four basic postures. Rising from the chair, twisting, turning, really it encompasses all the movements that our body goes through throughout the day. Something really important in the sutta is that there are references which talk about not only what we could be mindful of, but how to be mindful of it. This is important. When the Buddha said, know that you're sitting, know that you're standing, he's not talking about an intellectual sort of knowing. That's not mindfulness. Mindfulness is experiencing things directly. It's an experiential type of knowing. One thing I really like about this sutta is a phrase that he uses in different variations. So in this part of the sutta, he regularly says, feel the body within the body. Feel the body within the body. Or feel the breath within the breath. It's an odd-sounding phrase, isn't it? To me, it conveys this sense of mindfulness that it is a direct experience of physical sensation. It's not viewing things as if from afar. Mindfulness really is an experience of non-duality, where there is no self or witness or observer that's separate from the sensations it's experiencing, that's looking at it. It's just sensation happening. It's important, so I think I'll cull it out more with a really basic example. Let's say you're opening a door. You feel the arm reaching for the door. Feel the reaching within the reaching. Where do you feel it? What sensations are happening within the arm? Is it stretching, pulling, burning, pinching, whatever it is? Open the awareness to receive sensations completely. Grabbing the doorknob, just the grabbing within the grabbing. Gripping, contracting, pleasant, unpleasant, experiencing it completely. Maybe the touch of the doorknob is cool or hot. Just being there for it, just turning the knob, feeling the turning within the turning. The pulling open of the door, feeling the pulling within the pulling. Just sensation, just happening. That's it. That's an example of mindfulness of posture, mindfulness of the body. When I first started attending classes and retreats, I used to wonder why the teachers talked so much about being mindful of doing the dishes or opening the doors or things like that. I used to think, are they nuts? You know, it's like, I came here because I'm suffering and I want to really understand the meaning of life, and they're talking about washing the dishes. What's going on? Well, now I think I get it. And in terms of mindfulness of the body, maybe I can address two reasons for emphasizing something as basic and mundane as opening a door. First, if you are here to understand the meaning of life, what is mindfulness of the body? It is a direct connection with life. Not life as it is on TV or as we think it should be, but life as it really is, right here, right now. You know, sometimes I watch these science programs on public television, or I even read medical things sometimes, and I can be in such awe of what goes on in the body. But really, one doesn't need that kind of intellectual stimulation. Mindfulness of the body is enough. The mystery of the body can be experienced directly with our own awareness. If this is a day where that seems a little grandiose, here's another benefit of mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of posture, mindfulness of opening a door. It's really an ideal way of grounding oneself. It's a refuge. And I think that even those of us who feel like we have reasonably happy lives need refuges. You know, most of us have days where there's too much on our plate, we feel a little overwhelmed, or where one is really caught up in pleasures or irritations, or whatever it is, the mind gets preoccupied. It's not a restful state. Where can we find a refuge quickly? Well, the body's always here. Let me give an example of mindfulness of the body as a refuge that might make this more practical. I have a friend whose work life is rigorous. It's too demanding. And his schedule on Mondays is particularly rigorous and tiring. He's not in a position to change his Monday schedule. So he has to find some way of working with it. So one day, he said to me, "You know, I approached my Monday differently today." And he was feeling a fair amount more calm and relaxed when he got home. It's interesting what he did. You know how when there's a lot going on, when you feel like you have too much to do, if you're anything like me, you probably have a tendency to rush, to hurry through your day, to pick up the pace. Well, he decided on purpose to do the opposite. He slowed down all of his movements. He slowed down his speech. And he purposely became mindful of his body as he moved through his day. So, of course, he couldn't be mindful of every single moment, but the moments when he could be mindful were like mini refuges. And the mini refuges added up throughout the day so that it really affected his whole day. That's accessible. That's mindfulness of posture, and we can do it. I'd like to give another example that's in a different vein. I'm talking so much about the body, I don't really have too much time to go into emotions, but I really want to mention that mindfulness of the body is a great way for working with emotions, and especially difficult ones. Emotions are a mind-body phenomena. That is, obviously, emotions affect our minds. They also manifest in our bodies. You know, like that feeling when you're scared, you might feel shaky, or angry, you might feel tight. It's a mind-body thing. So here's an example from a student of mine who, several years ago, underwent rather severe trauma. And for a very extended period of time, was very afraid almost all of the time. She decided to use her meditation practice to deal with this fear. And she particularly relied on mindfulness of the body to help her. And at some point, she sent me a letter where she was describing what it was like to be mindful of the fear. Here's what she said. She's talking about the fear. "There was a feeling of wanting to push it away, to shrink from it, or scream." And that's a low-key statement for how she was feeling at times. But instead of shrinking from it or screaming, she tried to feel it in her body. She said, "The fear involves all kinds of tightness and heat in my body. but when I am in touch with it, I am not anxious. There's a peculiar lightness in all this, maybe even a freedom or wisdom. The fear involves all kinds of tightness and heat in my body. But when I am in touch with it, I am not anxious. There's a peculiar lightness in all this, maybe even a freedom or wisdom. So clearly, whether we're a little stressed out or suffering quite deeply, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of posture, is something that can ground us, something that can allow our hearts to stabilize, become more balanced. It's a refuge. Clearly, mindfulness of the body is a refuge that is always available for these mini moments. And there's also a cumulative effect that can occur as we're mindful in more and more moments of our life. As we become more and more mindful on a more and more regular basis, wisdom develops, as I mentioned earlier. In the Theravada Buddhist tradition, there are some pretty specific ways of understanding what wisdom is. One aspect of wisdom that the Buddha talked about a lot is what he referred to as the three characteristics of all conditioned things. The Buddha talked about these three characteristics again and again and again. And the reason he did so was because understanding them is so liberating. All of these three characteristics can be understood by being mindful of the body. The first characteristic, actually they're not in any particular order, but the first characteristic that I'm referring to tonight is that the body, like all conditioned things, is impermanent. It's subject to constant change. Second, the body, like all conditioned things, can't truly be called the self. Third, the body, like all conditioned things, because it's impermanent and can't be truly called the self, can't be the source of the deepest and most reliable happiness that we could find. It has a quality of not truly being able to satisfy. So, in other words, while the body can't be the source of our deepest happiness, it is a reliable vehicle for understanding all of these three qualities which lead to the wisdom that is the source of our deepest happiness. Hopefully this will become more clear as I go along. In the Theravada Buddhist canon, one of my favorite books is called the Therigata. The Therigata is a collection of enlightenment poems that were spoken, because this was an oral tradition, by the first nuns of the Buddha's time over 2,500 years ago. Each poem, mostly each poem, gives a taste of the individual nun's motivation for entering monastic life. Most of the poems give a little taste of what the nun's path to awakening entailed. And they all end with a description or declaration of the moment when insight penetrated her so fully that she became completely liberated. I'd like to share part of one of the poems with you. It's from an elderly nun named Dhamma. This is her description of the moment when she became fully liberated. I wandered for alms. I leaned on a stick. My whole body was weak and trembled. Suddenly I fell down and could see clearly the misery of this body. My heart was freed. When I first read these poems over 10 years ago, I was struck by how many of the poems, like Dhamma's, noted insight into the unreliability and impermanence of the body as key to their awakening. Suddenly I fell down and could see clearly the misery of this body. My heart was freed. I imagine that as you listen to this, you could have a variety of reactions. Some of you might feel inspired to hear of an elderly, disabled woman not only becoming fully liberated, but doing so in the context of so much difficulty. Others of you might have more cynical reactions. I can imagine what a variety of cynical reactions would be because I used to have so many of them. One of the cynical reactions that I would have had would have sounded something like this. Look, I've had a chronic illness since childhood, and the misery in my body is just plain misery. It hasn't freed my heart, and it's not gonna. Stop romanticizing disability already. I was a little angry. But, you know, there's some truth in that cynicism. I can only imagine that there are a number of you here who have experienced tremendous distress, suffering in your bodies due to injury, illness, aging, or various other factors. It's not a good time. I don't mean to romanticize it. But for me, reading of Dhamma's surrender to her body's propensity for suffering now brings tremendous relief. I think that what's happened over the years is that I've seen that every time I try to control my body, to get it to act the way I want or look the way I want or feel the way I want, I get disappointed. It feels good to just surrender. I want to be clear, too, that I don't think I get disappointed just because I have some health problems. Almost every day, I'm in contact with people who are pretty darn healthy and who are very preoccupied with trying to look thinner, be stronger, prevent illness through the right diet, change their appearance through cosmetics, cosmetic surgery, exercise. I mean, I want muscles too. I'm not knocking any of this, really. It is an act of compassion to take care of one's body. And in a culture where looks figure so prominently, it's unavoidable to pay some attention to our appearance. It's not a problem. The problem is when we make the leap from consciously and caringly tending to our bodies to deluding ourselves about their ultimate nature. When we look to our bodies for something that they can't provide, or if they do provide it, poof, it's gone. Anyone remember Joan Namath? This really cracks me up that I'm saying this because I know nothing about football. I have never watched a football game in my life. But he was so famous that, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, even I knew about his Super Bowl victory, his touchdowns, his awards. And as I recall it, I was young at the time, he seemed to be revered as a very handsome man, a ladies' man. So, you know, in terms of the body, this guy had it all. He had physical prowess, good looks. He was a physical icon. So imagine my surprise when he became a poster boy for arthritis medication. It is true that he does have osteoarthritis. The rumor was that at times he was severely disabled from it, and that it was due in part or in totality to the rigors of his football career. I was really struck by this transformation in his life. I didn't have words to express it or understand it at the time, but looking back, I can see that it was really one of my first experiences of going, wow, maybe the body's not what it's cracked up to be. Maybe it's not as reliable. Maybe it's more vulnerable than what I've thought. Another sports example. I remember, I think it was in the late 80s, there was a skater named Dan Jensen. He was an American who was heavily favored to win gold medals in the Olympics. I knew about him not because I followed skating, but because in the papers, you know, everybody was, you know, behind the American, and so he received a lot of press. And it became known that his sister, who he was apparently very close to, had leukemia. She'd had it for years. And apparently she said to him, no matter how I'm doing, no matter what's going on with me, I want you to go to those Olympics and skate. So the way it happened, on the morning of his first race, he got a call saying that she had just died. And as she had requested, he tried to skate anyway. Not only didn't he win, he actually fell and was eliminated from the race. Several days later, in subsequent races, the same thing happened. I mean, really, in those circumstances, who wouldn't fall? Who wouldn't fall? But again, you know, it drove home for me that even the most athletic body, while I mean, I don't have it, but I imagine it must be quite pleasurable. I'm sure it brings pleasure, but it doesn't ultimately protect one from all of life's losses. It doesn't ultimately protect one from the failures, disappointments, ups and downs that we can go through. So it becomes important to turn one's attention to what can be a more reliable source of happiness. This question brings me back again to that nun, Dhamma, and her story of awakening. And it brings me back again to the cynicism I had about romanticizing disability or frailty. I really do not see Dhamma's frailty as the important part of her story. When I think about it, if infirmity were enough to awaken us, there would be a lot of enlightened beings hobbling about. It's not happening. So what is it? I see the salient part of Dhamma's story as occurring in her phrase, "I could see clearly." Let me remind you of that part. She said, "Suddenly I fell down and could see clearly the misery of this body. My heart was freed." So the way I read it, it wasn't the fact that she suffered. It wasn't her disability or age. It was the fact that she met her suffering with mindfulness. Mindfulness is what allowed her to see the body's nature clearly. Mindfulness was what allowed her heart to let go and be free. Do you remember that television commercial where the woman goes, "I've fallen and I can't get up"? It was, you know, big in popular culture for some reason. But for those of you who don't remember it or didn't watch television, it was an elderly woman again, and the commercial was for an emergency response button that she wore around her neck. So if you can't get to the phone, you can press the button and reach assistance. The woman in the commercial was distressed when she fell down. And probably most or all of us would be too under those circumstances. If you fell down and you couldn't get up, do you think your heart would be instantly liberated? Or do you think you'd be afraid? I'm betting I would be scared. So, back to Dhamma. While her fall was accidental, her mindfulness was no accident. Dhamma had been practicing mindfulness ardently for years. She made herself ripe for insight. I know that I can't just be mindful for a few moments every now and again and expect that when I fall down or get sick or lose a loved one, my heart will suddenly be free. I'll surrender completely and see everything clearly. But practicing mindfulness on a regular basis, more and more one can make mindfulness second nature, so that there is this possibility in any moment, whether it's falling down or going to the bathroom or taking a shower or diapering a baby or doing whatever one does at work, doing anything can be an opportunity for complete awakening. So it's really about making ourselves ripe for insight. Brings me back to mindfulness of posture. Since our posture is with us all the time, everywhere, always an opportunity to awaken. So before I was emphasizing mindfulness of posture as a way of having a mini refuge right here, right now. We need these refuges. I'd also like to go back to the three characteristics that I was talking about, because all of them can be understood simply by paying attention to mindfulness of posture. For example, if one is paying attention to posture throughout the day, you'll notice that it is constantly changing, that it's impermanent. Mindfulness of posture is such that this won't be an intellectual sort of knowing. It won't be a cognitive reflection. You'll know impermanence in your gut because you're experiencing changes in physical sensations directly and experientially. One of the great things about mindfulness of posture is that you can understand impermanence this way, and you don't have to fall down or get sick in order to do it. It's kind of the scaredy cat's path to awakening. The characteristic of not self, or anatta, can also be understood by being mindful of posture. You know, it's easier for me to explain that if I do that one last. I'm going to back up to the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness and the unsatisfactory nature of the body, which can be understood through mindfulness of posture. I've talked about unsatisfactoriness a lot, but let me give you an example that's just focusing on changes in posture. One of the ways where it can be most easily perceived is if you notice the motivation for most of our changes in posture, or many of them. I was thinking about this earlier, and I thought about just a very typical slice of a non-eventful day for me. Let's say it's approaching dinner time. I notice that I'm hungry. I'm mindful of the physical sensations of hunger. It's unpleasant. It's a feeling of dissatisfaction. I want to go to relieve it. So I move. I get up from whatever I was doing. I go to the kitchen to get some food together. That's my motivation. Maybe I look in the refrigerator and maybe I see that there's leftovers that tasted perfectly good 2 days ago. But now there's some kind of craving for a new and improved sensory experience. The body wants something better. The mind wants something better. So I figure I'll spice the leftovers up, do something different. Maybe I pull out some vegetables that I'm going to add to them. So I move over to the sink. I'm washing the vegetables. Maybe the water is too cold. It's unpleasant. It's an unsatisfactory experience. So I adjust the water temperature. Maybe then a few minutes later, I'm slicing or chopping the vegetables. And I notice my bladder is too full. It's uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. It becomes the motivation for me to leave the kitchen and go to the bathroom and relieve myself. This is not sensational. I mean, this is just a small snippet of a day that might have been a very happy one. Imagine what unsatisfactory nature of the body might look like on a bad day or across a whole lifespan. So again, being mindful of posture is really the easy way to see into unsatisfactoriness. So this characteristic of not self, that the body is not self, I postponed it because I think it's easiest for me right now to explain it in conjunction with the characteristic of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. For example, you might start to notice that the unsatisfactoriness in your body is somewhat outside of your control. I mean, we can influence our bodies, but we don't really have final say. If we did, if the body were you, would you allow it to get so achy and fidgety when you're trying to have a peaceful meditation? On the same theme, would you let your body get sick when you're about to go on vacation or planning some big event? If the body were you, would you let the brain cells die, the muscles atrophy? Would you let it get heart disease despite the fact that you have good exercise and eating habits? If the body were you, couldn't you prevent it from dying? Another way to look at this not-self aspect of the body could be informal sitting practice. This is interesting because here, supposedly, the posture is totally still. Now, I know the way all of us meditate, if somebody was looking in from outside, we'd just look like perfectly still, unmoving statues, right? Well, let's just say. So, we're still, we're not moving a muscle. But is the body really still? What's happening inside the body? Well, it could be pulsing, pounding, throbbing. It could be lightness, numbness, tingling, vibration, waves of energy, all arising and dissolving, arising and dissolving, arising and dissolving. And the more we sit there, the more it might begin to just seem like tiny pinpoints of sensation endlessly coming and going, ceaseless. If the body is these tiny pulses of sensation always dissolving, how could we call that me? It's just sensation happening. This could sound intellectual, the way I'm speaking of it now. But really, being mindful of the body or mindful of posture, it won't be intellectual. It will be a direct experience. Insight into not self, anatta, like insight into impermanence and the unsatisfactory nature of the body, comes from that direct experience that I've been talking about, that direct connection with the body, with life, with the moment. And as our practice allows us to experience impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and anatta vividly in our guts, our attachment to the body releases. As attachment releases, then, like Dhamma, our hearts can become free.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.